Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Welcome. Let us just take a moment to settle our minds for a really profound inquiry today.
Yes, it is wonderful to be sharing this space with you all.
For centuries, you know, practitioners across absolutely all Buddhist traditions have revered Maitreya as the future Buddha.
Right.
We look to him as this, well, this ultimate embodiment of loving kindness, the inevitable successor who will turn the wheel of Dharma in the next era.
Exactly.
Yet, in our veneration of his future, we rarely pause to ask what is arguably the most radical question.
Which is, how does a being actually become a Buddha?
Exactly. Yeah. Today, we are not simply looking at a deity on a pedestal. We are going to examine the precise ancient mechanics of spiritual awakening.
It's quite a journey we have ahead.
It really is. We are opening a remarkable text, a very rare transmission, titled Maitreya Setting Out, The Origin of the Future Buddha.
Such a beautiful text.
It is. This is text number 198 from the Daje Kangyur, preserved for centuries in Tibet, and translated into English for us in the modern era by the 84,000 Project.
It is a profound joy to sit with this text today. To truly appreciate the gravity of what we are examining with you, we have to locate Maitreya within the vast landscape of the Dharma.
Right, because he really is everywhere.
He is. His presence is a rare point of absolute consensus. If you immerse yourself in the expansive philosophy of the Mahayana tradition, Maitreya is ubiquitous.
Yeah.
You find him in the Lotus Esotra. You find him engaging in profound debate in the Vimalakirti Esotra.
And it's not just the Mahayana.
No, not at all. If you turn to the Theravada tradition and the Pali Canon, specifically the Digha Nikaya, he is right there as well.
Prophesied by Shakyamuni Buddha himself.
Exactly. He is the universally recognized horizon of our spiritual lineage.
And yet, despite this universal presence, standalone canonical texts that focus entirely on his own personal genesis, you know, his specific journey from an ordinary suffering mind to the precipice of Buddhahood, they are exceedingly scarce.
Extremely rare, yes.
We usually just see him in the background of many teachings or acting as an interlocutor. But Maitreya Setting Out brings him to the absolute center.
It really shines a spotlight on him.
And we owe our access to this text to an unbroken lineage of dedication. It was originally translated from Sanskrit into Tibetan in the late 8th or early 9th century by the great Tibetan translator Yeshe Day.
Working painstakingly alongside revered Indian panditas.
Right, masters like Prajñāvarman, Jinamitra, and Surendra Bodhi. So when we read this, we are participating in a conversation kept alive by centuries of realized masters.
That is so important to remember. And the mission of our gathering today is not to merely recount a historical biography or recite a myth.
Right. It's highly practical.
Exactly. Our purpose is functional and immediate. We seek to understand the genesis of bodhicitta.
That miraculous, unyielding mind.
Yes, the mindset upon complete awakening for the benefit of absolutely all beings. We will trace Maitreya's journey backward through two unimaginably distant past lives to witness the exact moment that seed of Buddhahood was planted.
Wow.
And in doing so, we uncover the true, lived meaning behind his name. The loving one. And we begin to understand how that same seed might be cultivated in our own minds.
So as we enter the space of this esotra, I invite you to hold a specific analogy in your mind.
Oh, I love this analogy.
Engaging with this text is, well, it's very much like examining the foundational blueprints of a magnificent ancient temple.
Right.
So often as practitioners, we walk into a grand cathedral of Dharma and we just look up. We revere the finished architecture, the golden roof, the perfected presence of Maitreya.
The finished product, essentially.
Exactly. But this esotra takes us beneath the floorboards. It forces us to look at the deep earth being moved, to witness the very first rough stones being laid down in the mud eons and eons ago.
We are looking at the foundational geometry of an awakened mind.
Yes, before the temple was ever built.
That is a precise and vital way to approach this. And the text begins by establishing a foundational geometry of its own, the physical and spiritual environment of the teaching.
Let's set that scene.
The narrative opens with the Buddha Shakyamuni residing in the Jeta Grove within the park of Anathapitada at Shravasti.
Okay.
And the assembly surrounding him is staggering in its realization. The esotra specifies that the Buddha is accompanied by 5,000 monks and 10,000 irreversible bodhisattvas.
Just pause for a second. 10,000 irreversible Bodhisuttavas.
I encourage you to really feel the atmospheric weight of that assembly. 10,000 beings who have permanently severed the root of cyclic existence.
They can no longer fall back into the delusions of samsara.
Right. The silence in the Jetta Grove would have been thick, resonant, and entirely free of ordinary conceptual agitation.
And it's directly out of this majestic silence that the action of the Esotra arises.
The initial spark.
The Bodhisattva Maitreya respectfully stands. He drapes his shawl over one shoulder, kneels on his right knee, joins his palms together, and asks the Buddha for permission to present a question to settle his inner inquiries.
A standard, deeply respectful protocol. Very standard. But here, the narrative takes an abrupt, fascinating turn. Before the Buddha Shakyamuni can even open his mouth to respond, another figure steps forward to intervene.
And it's not just anyone.
No. It is Manjushri, the absolute embodiment of transcendent wisdom.
Manjushri's intervention is not a breach of etiquette. It is a surgical, philosophical strike.
It really is.
He places a seemingly impossible condition on Maitreya. Manjushri declares that the thus gone one will only grant Maitreya the opportunity to ask his question if Maitreya refrains from asking about the aggregates, the elements, or the sense fields.
So all the usual categories are out?
Completely out. Yeah. He must not ask how to bring an end to desire, anger, or ignorance. He must not ask about transcending samsara or achieving nirvyeshna.
Right.
He must not even ask about the path or the ultimate fruition of the path. And finally, Manjushri delivers the absolute restriction.
Which is?
Maitreya must present his inquiry without using words.
I must admit, when I first encountered this demand as a practitioner, my mind forcefully pushes back. Naturally. It's incredibly jarring.
Right. I feel the inherent paradox tearing at the fabric of how we learn. How can a student possibly ask a question without words?
It seems impossible.
How can one inquire without concepts? Is not the entire architecture of the Dharma reliant on teaching us concepts?
We certainly think so.
We desperately rely on terms like karma, samsara, and nirvyeshna to navigate our practice and understand our suffering. If Manjushri strips all of those conceptual tools away, what is left to ask?
And what mechanism do we even use to ask it, right?
Exactly.
Well, your discomfort is exactly the intended result. Manjushri is violently pulling the conceptual rug out from under both Maitreya and the listener.
He's forcing the issue.
Yes, he is forcing a confrontation with our addiction to labels. In the text, the Venerable Shariputra actually speaks up, voicing our exact confusion.
Thank goodness for Shariputra.
Right. He asks Manjushri to explain this extreme danger of imputing, of relying on conceptualization.
And how does Manjushri respond?
He responds by pointing directly to the ultimate nature of reality, to shanyata, or emptiness. He explains the profound nature of sameness.
Sameness?
Yes. All phenomena, from the lowest hell realm to the highest near Vahna, are strictly equal in their emptiness, their signlessness, and their unborn nature.
This leads to a specific, incredibly dense teaching from Manjushri within the text.
It's a crucial passage.
He says, and I really want you to listen to the exact phrasing here. Those who see sameness without seeing anything are seeing sameness. But those who create imputations perceive things as not sameness.
Let us unpack the mechanics of that statement carefully, because it is the linchpin of the Mahayana view.
Please.
What exactly does it mean to create imputations? It means that our dualistic mind looks at the seamless, uncompounded fabric of reality, and out of habit and fear, it immediately starts carving it up into separate, solid entities.
We categorize everything.
We do. We draw an artificial boundary and label one experience virtue and another non-virtue. We label one psychological state, samsafra, and a peaceful state, near vahna.
And the problem is, we believe those labels are real.
Exactly. The moment we apply these labels and believe they possess intrinsic reality, we are trapped. If I solidify the concept of near vahna, I immediately generate a grasping desire to attain it.
Right.
If I solidify samsara, I generate a desperate aversion to escape it. Both grasping and aversion are chains.
So the conceptual tools themselves become the trap.
The teaching here is that our conceptual tools, if misunderstood, become the very bars of our prison. The true realization of the Buddha is non-attachment to all phenomena, including the Dharma itself.
So Manjushri is essentially demanding that Maitreya prove he has internalized this ultimate truth before he is even permitted to speak to the Buddha.
It's a profound test.
And Maitreya's response is a masterclass in profound understanding. He doesn't flinch. He agrees completely with Manjushri.
He leans right into it.
He states that he always presents his inquiries in a way that does not contradict suchness. Maitreya explicitly acknowledges that from the perspective of ultimate truth, there is no transcending samsara and no attaining nirvijayana.
Because ultimately there is nowhere to go.
And no solid entity to travel there anyway. He recognizes that all words are empty echoes and all phenomena have been unborn from the very beginning.
By responding in this manner, Maitreya completely disarms the dualistic trap.
Yeah.
He passes Manjushri's test not by offering a clever philosophical retort, but by demonstrating a mind that rests comfortably in the baseless, ungraspable nature of reality.
And the assembly recognizes this instantly.
They do. Having proven his mastery of this profound view, Maitreya is immediately praised by another great being in the assembly, the Bodhisattva Playfulness.
And it is the Bodhisattva Playfulness who then turns to the Buddha and asks the crucial question that drives the rest of our exploration.
The inciting incident, really.
He asks the Buddha to reveal the origin of Maitreya's journey. How much time has passed since this extraordinary being first gave rise to the mindset on awakening?
And the Buddha Shakyamuni's response necessitates a radical shift in our perspective.
It's definitely not a simple answer.
No, he does not simply provide a number or a historical date. He transports the entire assembly, and by extension, he transports you, the listener, on a journey into the abyss of deep time.
He takes us back countless unfathomable eons.
Yes, to describe an era known as the epoch of the Buddha Pure Golden Light.
And the Esto's description of the environment of this past Buddha field is not just poetic.
It's highly specific.
Right, it's a highly specific epistemological metaphor. The Buddha describes a realm where there is no sun, no moon, no planets, and no stars.
Nothing. This imagery is breathtaking. If we consider our own world, we are entirely reliant on external dependencies.
Very true.
We need the sun or a lamp to see our physical surroundings, just as psychologically, we constantly rely on external structures, relationships, and validation to illuminate our sense of self.
We always need something outside of us to cast a light.
But in the realm of the Buddha Pure Golden Light, those external dependencies are rendered obsolete. It is a realm of pure, unmediated perception.
Wow.
Reality is illuminated not from external sources casting shadows, but from the direct, self-existing luminosity of an awakened mind.
And the way they measure time in this realm without celestial bodies is equally profound.
Yes, the golden lotuses.
The text tells us that golden lotuses, the size of chariot wheels, blossom in the morning. Their fragrance permeates the universe.
Beautiful.
Then in the afternoon, they naturally wither. This gentle, organic blossoming and fading is the sole marker of the passing days.
It is an environment calibrated for supreme subtlety. And within this luminous, subtle environment, the Buddha Pure Golden Light teaches a singular, overarching dharma.
The core teaching of this era.
It is called the Irreversible Wheel of the Bodhisattva Collection. The core mechanism of this teaching is radically non-dual.
How so?
He teaches that absolutely no phenomena whatsoever can be divorced from suchness, from the ultimate nature of reality.
This is where the teaching challenges the listener directly, and where we must tread carefully.
Extremely carefully.
It is easy enough to accept that a beautiful golden lotus is not separate from ultimate reality.
Sure.
But the Esotra pushes us into the darkest corners of our experience. It explicitly states that desire cannot be divorced from the essential nature of desire.
Yes.
Anger cannot be divorced from the essential nature of anger. Ignorance cannot be divorced from the essential nature of ignorance.
And we must understand the profound psychological mechanics at play here.
Break that down for us.
Normally, when an ordinary practitioner feels intense anger or overwhelming desire, the immediate instinct is suppression or flight.
Right. We want to push it away.
We view the anger as a solid, dark, invasive entity that has corrupted our pure mind, and we seek to destroy it or distance ourselves from it.
But this teaching says no.
This teaching demands that we stop running. It asks us to turn around and look directly into the face of the anger itself.
That sounds terrifying.
It can be. But when we apply the lens of emptiness, we find that the essential nature of the anger is the absence of entity.
It has no core.
Exactly. It has no solid core. It is a temporary, uncompounded movement of energy. Because it is empty, it cannot be separated from the sphere of reality, which is also empty.
So by realizing that, we diffuse it.
Yes. By realizing the empty, fluid nature of our afflictions, they instantly lose their power to compel our behavior. They are recognized as mere imputations, as harmless and ungraspable as empty space.
Because this philosophical foundation is so absolute, it inevitably changes how beings in this realm practice devotion.
Everything changes.
The Esotra introduces us to the central figure of this ancient era, a universal monarch named King Goldencolor.
This is such a pivotal figure.
And this king is driven by a devotion that shatters our ordinary paradigms. The text states that for 840 million years, King Goldencolor reveres the Buddha pure golden light with physical offerings that stretch the very bounds of human imagination.
The sheer scale of these offerings is a deliberate mechanism.
It really overwhelms you.
It is meant to overwhelm our mundane sense of proportion and limitation. King Goldencolor constructs a courtyard that is 84 leagues in length.
Unimaginable size.
He covers the entire expanse of the ground with exquisite flowers piled up to the knees of anyone walking through them. He adorns the sky above with infinite garlands of red pearls.
Wow.
He constructs a path 2,000 leagues long, lined entirely with precious platforms, ponds of pure beryl filled with lotus flowers, and millions of attendants holding banners, burning incense, and playing divine musical instruments.
The physical wealth is staggering. But the text reveals that the true magic lies in how the Buddha interacts with these offerings.
That's the real marvel.
The Esotra describes a moment when the Buddha and his retinue of bodhisattvas begin to walk down this 2,000-league path. As they walk, unsupported parasols spontaneously appear in the sky above them.
Just floating.
Right. These parasols follow the walkers perfectly, gliding through the air without anyone holding them. Hanging from the edges of these parasols are nets of small golden bells.
And what do these bells do?
As the wind moves through the bells, they don't merely ring. They emit intricate melodies that are actually specific, tailored Dharma teachings.
It's brilliant.
Miraculously, these teachings adapt instantly to the minds of whoever hears them. A person whose mind is ripe for generosity hears the bells sing of generosity.
Yes.
A being ready for ultimate truth hears the profound melodies of emptiness and non-arising.
This is the ultimate representation of skillful means. It demonstrates the spontaneous, effortless, and perfectly responsive activity of an awakened mind.
The Buddha doesn't even have to speak.
He does not need to give a standardized lecture. His very presence causes the environment to respond exactly to the karmic needs of each sentient being.
Incredible.
And amidst this symphony of tailored teachings, the personal parasol floating above the Buddha pure golden light himself emits a very specific foundational doctrine.
The seal.
Yes, it is called the teaching of the seal of the thus gone ones.
I really want to quote the text directly regarding this seal because the analogy it uses is vital for our understanding of emptiness.
Please do.
The text states, quote, "For example, carving a seal out of space is not easy. There is nothing there that is a seal, and no imprint can be made. Why is it so? Because there is no basis, there are no causes and no conditions, nothing is produced, and there is no support." End quote.
We must dissect this analogy of space meticulously as it holds the key to liberation.
It's very dense.
It is. Consider the physical mechanics of a traditional seal. To leave a mark, you require two solid elements. First, you need a rigid matrix, like a heavy brass ring or a carved stone, into which a specific shape is etched. Second, you need a receptive, conditioned substance, like hot wax or soft clay, upon which the imprint is forcefully pressed.
Makes sense.
Both the seal and the wax must possess solid, independent, conditioned existence for an imprint to be successfully transferred and maintained.
Exactly. Now, let us try to apply those mechanics to space.
Let's try.
Imagine taking that heavy brass signet ring and thrusting it with all your might into the empty air in front of you.
Just pushing it into nothing.
You push, but you meet absolutely no resistance. The air does not push back. And when you pull your hand away, nothing whatsoever is left behind.
Absolutely nothing.
There is no mark, no boundary, no lasting impression. The space remains completely unchanged, unscarred, and unpolluted.
It's profound.
When we deeply internalize this analogy, we experience a profound revelation about the nature of our own minds and our psychological suffering.
Yes. How does it apply to our minds?
If our minds are fundamentally like space, empty of intrinsic solid existence, then our deep-seated anxieties, our rigid identities, our grasping desires, and our traumas have absolutely nothing to stick to.
They slide right off.
They're like phantom seals trying desperately to leave a permanent imprint on thin air.
The relief that comes from that realization is absolute. The Esotra tells us that a true bodhisattva knows with certainty that all phenomena share these exact attributes of space.
They cannot be affixed.
They cannot be held. They are mere imputations of a confused mind. To genuinely understand the seal of the Thus Gone Ones is to recognize that everything we perceive as a solid, enduring problem is fundamentally baseless.
Baseless. I love that word.
Recognizing this baselessness is the exact mechanism that frees the mind from the crushing weight of samsara.
And this inherent emptiness of phenomena naturally necessitates a radical shift in how we understand ethical conduct and practice in the world.
Yes, it shifts from the theoretical to the very practical.
Following the vast offering of the king, the Buddha Pure Golden Light sits down to teach the assembly. Here, he delivers a discourse known as the Individual Gateways of the Bodhisuttivas.
The six Paramitas.
Right. These gateways are what practitioners commonly know as the six perfections, or Paramitas. Generosity, discipline, patience, diligence, concentration, and insight.
It is crucial to understand that because the Buddha Pure Golden Light has just established this radical, non-dual foundation of space, he does not teach the six perfections as a standard, mundane list of ethical rules.
He redefines them.
He systematically breaks down each perfection, and in doing so, he completely reframes the definition of a fault for a bodhisuttiva.
He is elevating the discourse.
Elevating it from conventional karmic morality to the ultimate, uncompromising ethics of complete awakening.
This reframing culminates in what is arguably the most shocking, challenging, and difficult passage in the entire Esotra.
It is extremely provocative.
It fundamentally upends our conventional sense of right and wrong. When discussing the perfection of discipline, the Buddha explicitly states that a bodhisuttiva could commit the five acts of immediate retribution.
Just to clarify for everyone.
Yes, to contextualize this, in Buddhist cosmology, these are the five absolute worst karmic offenses imaginable.
The darkest acts.
They include horrific acts like killing one's own mother, killing one's father, or intentionally causing the blood of a Buddha to flow. These are acts so intensely negative that they supposedly guarantee immediate uninterrupted rebirth in the lowest hell realms.
Unthinkable karma.
Yet, the Esotra states that if a bodhisuttiva commits these horrific acts, but never abandons the mindset on awakening, if they never lose their bodhicitta, and if they avoid conceptual fixation on the reality of the act, then their discipline remains, quote, intact and unpolluted.
I know this is hard to hear.
I must push back firmly against this. As practitioners, how do we reconcile this? How can committing a violent, heinous act not instantly shatter one's spiritual discipline?
It's a very fair question.
Is this not a deeply dangerous teaching that a misguided person could use to justify horrific behavior while claiming ultimate motives?
Your pushback is entirely justified, and it is the necessary reaction to this teaching. The Buddha intends to shock the listener in order to force a confrontation with the absolute unrivaled supremacy of bodhicitta on the Mahayana path.
Okay, so it's intentional shock value.
First, we must state unequivocally, this text is not providing a loophole for abuse, nor is it encouraging harm.
Thank you.
What it is doing is drawing a stark, uncompromising distinction between conventional karma and ultimate spiritual trajectory.
Conventional versus ultimate.
Exactly. Conventional rules, the ethics of avoiding harm, govern our trajectory within samsara. If you commit a terrible act, the mechanics of karma are inescapable.
You will suffer.
You will absolutely experience the agonizing karmic ripening of that act in future lifetimes. The Esotra does not deny this. It acknowledges that such actions generate immense suffering and difficult rebirths.
So, if I understand this, the text is suggesting that even as the bodhisuttiva plummets into a hell realm due to the karmic weight of their action, if the flame of bodhicitta remains lit, their ultimate path to Buddhahood is somehow unbroken.
Precisely. Because bodhicitta, that unwavering, desperate commitment to liberate all sentient beings, is the sole exclusive engine of ultimate awakening.
It's the only thing that ultimately matters.
Yes. The Buddha is defining what constitutes true spiritual death for a bodhisuttiva, and that death is not a conventional moral failing.
Then what is it?
The ultimate unforgivable fault is giving up on sentient beings.
Wow.
The Esotra explains this through a devastating contrast. Imagine a practitioner who follows every conventional rule perfectly. They are immaculate.
The perfect monk.
They never harm an insect. They meditate flawlessly. But they adopt the attitude of a hearer or a solitary Buddha, meaning they decide the suffering of the world is too much. They seek only their own personal peace, and they turn their back on the cries of others.
Seeking near vahna just for themselves.
The Buddha states that this attitude is the worst form of corrupted, broken, and polluted discipline.
Because they abandon the vow.
By contrast, a bodhisattva who makes catastrophic conventional mistakes, who falls into hellish suffering as a result, but who refuses to abandon a single suffering being in that hell, keeps the inner core of their vow immaculate.
That is a profound, terrifying pivot. It demands that we look past the surface of an action and examine the deepest, most ultimate trajectory of the mind.
And this radical reframing applies to all the other perfections as well.
Like what?
Well, for instance, the text discusses the subtle trap of biased loving kindness.
Biased loving kindness.
It states that if a practitioner thinks, I will be generous to this worthy person, but not to that difficult one, or I will explain the Dharma to this receptive student, but ignore that ignorant one, they have committed a severe fault against their bodhisattva vow.
True Mahayana equanimity must be fiercely impartial.
It must be like the sun, which does not choose who receives its warmth, or like space, which accommodates both a temple and a slaughterhouse without bias or alteration.
It also addresses the very subtle, high-level traps of advanced spiritual practice.
Yes, the perfection of concentration.
Consider the fault of becoming addicted to the blissful isolation of meditation. A practitioner might withdraw into deep solitude, master the mind, experience profound, blissful concentration, and simply decide to stay there.
It's very tempting.
They become attached to that profound peace. But if they remain in isolation, enjoying their bliss and failing to use skillful means to engage with the messy, suffering world, they have failed.
They have committed a fault against the perfection of concentration.
The Esso Otra instructs that they must cultivate baseless concentration, a state of resting inwardly in the profound nature of emptiness, without any conceptual reference points, while simultaneously maintaining a heart that is infinitely actively available to the suffering of the world.
Now, if material offerings and conventional morality are ultimately bound by the limitations of conventional reality,
then what is the true currency of awakening?
Exactly. This question brings us to a monumental turning point in the narrative.
Back to King Golden Color.
Yes. King Golden Color has spent 840 million years making unimaginably vast physical offerings to the Buddha pure golden light.
A truly staggering amount of time.
He has accumulated merit on a scale that defies mathematics. Finally, this massive period of devotion comes to an end. On the very last day, the king observes the Buddha preparing to depart the realm.
And the king is faced with a critical decision.
Operating under a conventional understanding of spiritual economics, he wonders to himself, should I dedicate all this vast merit I have accumulated to becoming a heavenly king like Sakra or Brahma? Or should I dedicate it to becoming a universal monarch who rules the four physical continents?
The king is treating his merit like currency.
He is. He has paid a massive price in time, energy, and resources, and he is wondering what worldly or heavenly reward he can purchase with it.
But the Buddha pure golden light intervenes.
Perfectly reading the king's mind, he orchestrates a spectacular intervention to shatter this limited view. He emanates an exact replica of his own perfect, radiant body high into the sky above the assembly.
And from the sky, this emanated Buddha delivers a piercing, poetic teaching on the utter inadequacy of worldly and heavenly aspirations.
The verses the emanation speaks are incredibly powerful.
They really are. The Buddha in the sky refers to the desire for heavenly rebirths as the behavior of a childish man.
Quite a critique.
He points out the inescapable flaw in the king's logic. Life as a great king or a powerful god is still impermanent. It is perishable.
It is still within samsara.
It will eventually exhaust itself, leading to another fall. And then he delivers a teaching that completely upends the king's calculus of merit.
This is the turning point.
I will quote the text. Compared to someone who, longing for near vahana, makes offerings to the Buddhas, by filling an entire trichiliocosm with precious substances, someone who joins their palms together and dedicates this act mentally to the attainment of awakening creates much more merit, even without pronouncing a single word.
We really must pause to grasp the mechanics of this truth.
It's massive.
This is the definitive statement on the absolute supremacy of the mind over material action. You could literally fill the entire physical universe with gold, jewels, and perfect lotuses as an offering.
A physical impossibility, but yes.
But a single silent internal moment of genuine bodhicitta, a single baseless wish for the ultimate awakening and liberation of all sentient beings, is infinitely more powerful.
Something like that.
Because material offerings, no matter how vast, are finite. They are conditioned. They produce a result within samsara, like a thousand-year lifespan as a god, which will inevitably run out. Yeah. But bodhicitta is an unconditioned aspiration. Its object is infinite. the liberation of all beings. Because its target is unconditioned and infinite, the merit it generates is inexhaustible. It cannot be spent. It can only culminate in Buddhahood.
The impact of understanding this mechanism on King Golden Color is immediate and absolute.
It shifts his entire being.
The text tells us that he abandons all his worldly ambitions on the spot. With a dauntless, completely resolved mind, he officially gives rise to the mindset on awakening.
He generates bodhicitta.
He takes the great vow to become a Buddha in order to liberate all beings. And the text states that the moment this internal shift occurs, the very fabric of the universe reacts.
The earth shakes in six different ways.
It is a cosmic event. Inspired by the sheer force of his vow, millions of his followers, his family, and his subjects spontaneously generate bodhicitta as well. They collectively renounce their worldly lives and enter the path of pure conduct.
And it is precisely at this crescendo in the ancient narrative that the Buddha Shakyamuni, sitting with his assembly back in the Jeddah Grove, drops an absolutely shocking revelation about the identity of these figures.
This is the twist.
He looks at his listeners and reveals that King Golden Color was none other than the past incarnation of Maitreya.
So this magnificent event we just witnessed was the exact moment Maitreya first generated bodhicitta.
It was his absolute starting line.
But the revelation does not end there. The Buddha Shakyamuni then reveals his own role in that ancient era.
This part is astounding.
He tells the assembly that he too was present in that magnificent courtyard. He was there incarnated as Sukra, the Lord of the Gods.
The very God King Golden Color was considering becoming.
Exactly. And with profound humility, the Buddha confesses his own spiritual blindness at that time. He admits that he watched the Buddha pure golden light. He admired the Buddha aesthetically. He thought the physical form of the Buddha was beautiful and pleasant to look at. But he reveals he did not give rise to the mind of awakening. He merely paid respectful service with a baseless, worldly mind.
Wow. Okay.
In fact, Shakyamuni Buddha reveals that he did not generate bodhicitta until 84,000 eons after Maitreya did.
Let us sit with the implications of this, because they dismantle our assumptions about spiritual progress.
They really do.
First, the profound humility of Shakyamuni Buddha in sharing this is staggering. He is the fully awakened one, the supreme teacher of our era, yet he openly admits to a past state of superficiality.
Admitting he was just admiring the aesthetics.
Exactly, of being a god who cared only for appearances while Maitreya was undertaking the ultimate cosmic vow.
And a second implication.
Second, it illustrates a crucial mechanism of spiritual maturation. Realization is not a linear process, and it cannot be absorbed via osmosis.
You can't just catch it from someone.
You can be standing in the direct presence of a fully awakened Buddha. You can be a powerful god offering veneration. But if the internal, radical, structural shift of bodhicitta does not occur within your own mind, you remain spiritually dormant.
It's an internal revolution.
The generation of bodhicitta is a distinct, momentous, entirely internal event that no one else can do for you.
So this historical twist leads us to ask, once the vow is taken, how does one proceed?
Right. What is the action plan?
The Buddha Pure Golden Light explains to the newly ordained King Golden Color, Maitreya, that there is a single overarching quality that ensures swift awakening. He calls this quality conscientiousness.
Conscientiousness.
Now, when we hear the word conscientiousness in a mundane context, we might think of being punctual or dutifully paying our bills.
They're very mundane.
But the Esso Notrad defines it much more radically. Conscientiousness here is the unbreakable bridge between the profound view of emptiness and the vast action of compassion.
It's the synthesis.
It means an unyielding commitment to never giving up on any sentient being, no matter how difficult, hostile, or resistant they are. It means relying deeply on spiritual friends, maintaining a mind that is infinitely flexible and free from rigidity, and observing profound loving kindness while simultaneously understanding that all phenomena are non-arising and similar to space.
Conscientiousness is the operational mode of a bodhisuchitiva. The text further breaks down the mechanics of this path to swift awakening into four specific qualities that must be cultivated simultaneously.
What are?
First, a firm, unshakable commitment to pursue virtuous qualities without ever succumbing to exhaustion or feeling disheartened by the immensity of the task.
Okay, with stamina.
Second, complete purity of discipline, not as a rigid adherence to dogmatic rules, but as a spontaneous, flawless expression of an awakened mind that naturally avoids harm.
Right, natural discipline.
Third, observing loving-kindness while absorbed in baseless concentration. This is the union of love and emptiness we discussed earlier. And fourth, a genuine, lived understanding of emptiness, realizing that all conditioned phenomena completely lack intrinsic nature and remaining in that profound bliss without ever solidifying a conceptual reference point.
To vividly illustrate how Maitreya embodies these four qualities, the Buddha Shakyamuni jumps the narrative forward in time to yet another past life.
Another iteration of Maitreya's journey.
In this era, operating under the guidance of the Buddha Ratnachatra, Maitreya is incarnated as a monk named Duhamati. And it is in the life of Duhamati that we witness the absolute, uncompromising, almost terrifying nature of his compassion and action.
Terrifying is a good word for it.
The monk Duhamati takes a specific vow of fasting, but it is not a standard passive fast for personal purification.
No.
He vows that he will not take a single bite of food each day until he has successfully established exactly 100 beings in the five fundamental precepts.
The mechanics of this vow are staggering. He ties his own physical survival directly to the spiritual elevation of others.
He leverages his own life.
The text tells us he wanders endlessly through 84,000 cities, towns, and chaotic marketplaces. On some days, karma is favorable, and he finds his 100 people quickly, allowing him to eat.
But not always.
No. Other times, the environment is resistant. It takes him 2, 3, or even 7 agonizing days to find and establish 100 beings in the precepts.
7 days.
And for those entire 7 days, he consumes nothing. He walks, he speaks, and he teaches on a completely empty stomach, his physical body deteriorating, driven entirely by an unstoppable, burning compassion.
It's just relentless.
For 84,000 years, he maintains this brutal vow without ever losing courage. He establishes 36 quintillion beings in the precepts, and then spends tens of thousands of additional years leading them toward awakening and teaching them the intricacies of meditative absorption.
The culmination of Duhamati's relentless effort results in a phenomenon that the Esotra describes as a miracle, but which is actually the natural result of perfecting interdependent origination.
A shift in reality.
Duhamati gives his followers oral instructions on the absorption of loving-kindness. But his own internal realization of this state is so absolute, so intensely concentrated and free of dualistic boundaries, that it begins to forcefully alter the physical world around him.
The energy spills over.
The text states that when he goes begging for alms, the very moment he steps his foot onto the physical threshold of a village or a home, the sentient beings inside that dwelling automatically, spontaneously, and without any instruction, enter the deep absorption of loving kindness themselves.
Just by his presence.
His mere physical presence induces a state of profound, unshakable peace and love in the mental continuums of everyone nearby.
We must understand how this works within the Mahayana framework. This is not magic. It is the perfection of shunyata.
Emptiness in action.
Duhamati has completely eradicated the boundary between self and other. His loving kindness is no longer an emotion that a solid self feels toward a solid other.
It's not directional.
Exactly. It has become the very atmosphere he carries with him. Because all minds are fundamentally connected in their shared emptiness, when a mind resting perfectly in non-dual loving kindness enters a space, it naturally harmonizes the mental continuums of those in proximity.
Like a tuning fork.
And it is witnessing the staggering manifestation of non-dual love that prompts a cosmic reaction. The gods residing in the realms above the earth witness this transmission of peace, and they cry out in sheer amazement.
They realize who he is.
They proclaim aloud. This Bodhisattva great being is Maitreya. The word Maitreya literally translates to the loving one. This proclamation echoes up through the celestial realms, heaven by heaven, until it reaches the ears of the Buddha Ratnachatra.
And the Buddha Ratnachatra hears this universal proclamation and rejoices. He makes the formal, irreversible prophecy that from that exact moment forward, throughout all his infinite future rebirths, and even upon his final supreme awakening, this being will bear the name Maitreya.
He will permanently be known as the Loving One.
This revelation brings our inquiry full circle, perfectly linking us back to the question that started everything. This is why Maitreya is the unanimously recognized future Buddha.
It's not arbitrary.
It is not simply an honorary title he was handed by Shakyamuni. It is the inevitable result of an evolutionary process where his profound, uncompromising realization of emptiness, his absolute understanding of the seal of space, became perfectly indissolubly married to an unstoppable, active, fasting compassion that would literally starve itself to serve a single living being.
As we draw this teaching to a close, we must synthesize the two massive foundational pillars that uphold this esotra.
Yes, let's bring it together.
On one side, we have the uncompromising, razor-sharp view of emptiness. We witness this in Manju S.H.R.'s initial demand for non-conceptual inquiry, where words themselves were recognized as traps.
The seal of space.
We saw it in the profound teaching of the seal of space, where we learned that all phenomena, including our deepest traumas and our highest virtues, are as baseless and ungraspable as an imprint attempting to leave a mark on empty air.
And the other pillar.
On the other side, we have the vast, relentless, heat-generating action of bodhicitta and loving-kindness. We saw this in Maitreya's willingness to endure the physical agony of starving for 7 days just to help a handful of beings, and in his perfected ability to plunge entire hostile villages into profound peace simply by crossing their thresholds.
These two pillars are not separate philosophies. They are the two indispensable wings of the same bird.
Perfectly balanced.
To realize emptiness without cultivating compassion is to fall into a dead, isolated, nihilistic void. To practice compassion without a deep understanding of emptiness is to eventually burn out, crushed by the endless, heavy suffering of samsara.
Maitreya's journey shows us the perfect, necessary union of the two.
And we must draw a direct, uncomfortable line from this ancient text into the reality of your own daily practice. How often do we, acting much like King Golden Color in his early days, attempt to conventionally buy our spiritual peace?
Far too often.
How often do we approach our practice as a karmic transaction, trying to accumulate merit through perfectly performed rituals or external generosity, secretly hoping to earn a little comfort, a little relief within samsara?
This text dismantles that transactional view.
Completely.
It reminds us that a single, genuine moment of bodhicitta, a true, unconditioned, baseless wish for the ultimate liberation of every single being, creates infinitely more merit than filling the physical universe with jewels.
It's all about the mind.
It demands that we examine the power of conscientiousness in our daily lives. The simple, profoundly difficult act of never giving up on anyone and never allowing our minds to become rigid with concepts.
We began this session by comparing this esotra to the foundational blueprints of a magnificent temple.
We did.
We have spent this time examining the deep earth being moved. We've witnessed the genesis of the ultimate vow that will eventually culminate in the next turning of the Dharma wheel. We've seen the blueprint of Maitreya's mind.
It is a beautiful blueprint to study.
As we conclude, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to carry with you into your meditation, a profound question raised by the strange historical twist revealed in the middle of this esotra.
The timeline of their awakening.
Yes. Consider this deeply. The text explicitly states that Maitreya set out on the path, generating the mind of awakening 84,000 eons before our Buddha Shakyamuni did.
A massive head start.
He had an incomprehensibly massive head start. He was on the path while Shakyamuni was still a god distracted by aesthetics. Yet, it was Shakyamuni who achieved final Buddhahood first, becoming the supreme Buddha of our current era, while Maitreya remains a bodhisattva waiting patiently in the heaven of joy.
It's quite a paradox.
What does this paradox tell us about the nature of time, of diligence, and of the bodhisattva path itself? Why is the one who started first finishing second?
It's something we all need to sit with.
Perhaps it is not a matter of Maitreya being slower or lacking diligence. Perhaps knowing the absolute depth of his name, the loving one, his boundless compassion intentionally keeps him in the wings.
He chooses to wait.
Perhaps he is waiting, holding back his final awakening, intentionally delaying his own ultimate peace for the exact destined moment in the deep future when the universe will be plunged into its absolute darkest age and when suffering sentient beings will need his unstoppable transformative love the most.
A profound thought.
I invite you to sit with that thought. Allow the vastness of that kind of patience, that kind of love, to settle into your own mind. We thank you for joining us in this profound space today. May this teaching benefit all beings.
Authentic Tibetan teachings and transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.